reschedule one of the sessions because I've since discovered that we have conflicts on Tuesdays and Thursdays and stuff like that. So I've been trying to work that out. But, you know, there's always a tendency after the first exam to kind of get caught up in your other classes and not do too much work in this class. And I understand that. It's just, this is one of those classes where it takes some time for the material to sink in. So it's really useful in this class to do things incrementally. Some of you probably learned you can't really cram. So the exam, the week of the exam, and get very far. But anyway, okay, so what I want to talk about today is a discrete Fourier transform. Last time I talked in the spring, we had an IEEE talk. We did that earlier in the semester, and then we did a career day talk. Career day, I think, actually happened already, end of January.
Yeah.
Is that right? But the one thing I wanted to comment about all that, we talked about the importance of the IEEE. In terms of job searches and such, I know many of you are really nervous about the job market and such. The job market's actually not that bad. It could be a lot worse. But because engineers tend to be involved in very specialized jobs, there's kind of always a market for those things, and somewhat independent of the economy. One sector of the economy that's actually doing pretty well right now, which I've been involved in the past few years, is the intelligence community, which involves doing classified work. And some of the companies that are still hiring pretty aggressively are the companies that do a lot of classified work. And they don't say that in their announcements, but some of the major defense firms, used to be known as the aerospace firms, the Lockheed Martins and the SAICs and Northrop Grumman's and companies like this, are hiring, and a lot of their opportunities do exist on the classified side if you're a U.S. citizen. So when they hire you, when they interview you, they'll ask you a lot of questions about that. And then when you get hired, they'll apply for your security clearance. So they'll put you in some kind of temporary job for 9 months or 6 months while you get your clearance, and then they'll move you into the classified world. And the classified world's actually doing pretty well right now because it's funded by the government. It's not subject to a lot of these economic cycles. And there are some really good job opportunities in that sector. So when you look at these ads for the defense companies, the ad may not be representative of all the opportunities that they really have.
Did you see the email I sent out recently looking for people for those positions?
Which email?
The one that looked like spam. I sent out one to all the students in ACE, and it had purple text that was random sizes, and I was tempted to send them back, saying it looked horrible.
Yeah, I don't think I got that. I might have just gone to my spam filter. I don't think there was anything sort of approved that was sent that way. But
I can forward it.
Yeah, forward it to me.
It was pretty horrible.
But a couple of the companies I work with closely, Lockheed Martin and SAIC, I know are hiring. Yeah. But the main thing I wanted to say about career days, which is sort of relevant to this course, is that it's important to start looking for work at least a year in advance of when you actually plan to start work. And a lot of students don't appreciate this, but after you go through the whole process, you look back and say, you know, I really should have started earlier, because it takes a long time to, between the on-site interviews, getting your offer, and all the other stuff that happens, it takes a long time for that to happen, and doing all that in one semester doesn't really work very well. So if you were attending the career day session this semester, for example, hopefully you're thinking about graduation at the end of this calendar year. Trying to do everything in one semester is pretty tight. So whenever these career days come up, do go to them. Even if you're 2 or 3 years out from graduation or whatever, go to them, because it takes a while to kind of get through the whole hiring process. The other thing to think about, of course, is when the economy is bad and there's not a lot of opportunities out there that really excite you, then you think about graduate school. It's always a lot of people will head back to graduate school when the job market's not good, get some additional skills and then be able to get a better job when the economy gets better. And in case you're not aware of how graduate school works for engineers, there's really only one thing you need to know, which is it's all paid for. You know, as engineers, you'll get teaching assistantships, you get research assistantships, one way or the other. As an engineering graduate student, you'll get it all paid for. Meaning tuition will be paid by the university, and you'll get like a $1,500 a month stipend. So it costs you nothing other than some time to go to graduate school. And I think every good engineering student should get a master's degree in today's world. That's a no-brainer, in my opinion. So think about graduate school if you're finding your job prospects aren't too good, because in a year, graduate school, you can usually do a master's in about a year and a half, 2 years. It's really a good investment. Over the long term, it does make a big difference in your earning potentials and the types of jobs that you can have. And the jobs that you get with a master's degree are actually, they tend to be somewhat immune to all these economic cycles, because you're higher up the totem pole. You're more like in a management level. You have a position that's considered valuable to the company. You're not just some entry level engineer who's doing, you know, some very generic things. So think about it. It's a good way to advance your skills in times when the economy is bad. But I don't think the job market's awful right now, considering what's happening nationally, because normally high-tech firms do try to invest in times of economic downturn, because they have to start producing new products and things to get out of the bad business situation that they're in. So very often during economic downturns is when companies make a lot of significant investments in new technologies and things. So, okay. So let's talk about the discrete Fourier transform. And today we'll talk a little theory, but mostly some practical issues and discuss how we can use this to model some signals and such. So last time we introduced the discrete Fourier transform, and we showed the analysis and synthesis equations. The main equation we'll focus on today is the analysis equation, which says to compute the Fourier transform of a signal, discrete Fourier transform, we sum x of n times e to the minus j omega n. And today we'll go through in a couple examples of how to compute this, just so you're somewhat comfortable with that. But we'll also show how easy it is to do that in MATLAB. Now, this particular formulation is not really practical for real-time processing. So next class, we'll introduce something called the fast Fourier transform, which is a fast way to compute that. But this formulation also has a problem in that it involves summing from n equals minus infinity to plus infinity. That's not something you can do easily on the computer. So one of our solutions to this is to limit the extent of the summation to n points. Instead of taking n from minus infinity to plus infinity, we're going to take n from 0 n minus 1. Another thing that we'll do, this is a continuous function of frequency. This is not too easy to deal with on a computer, though we do have some valid tools these days, but it might be better to actually sample this function and represent it as a discrete set of points. So we'll also evaluate the continuous function of frequency at n equispaced points. So we're going to write x of e of j omega sampled at omega is equal to 2 pi divided by capital N times k, and that we're going to call x of k, and that then gives us, combining, limiting the sum and the sampling, we can actually write this discrete Fourier transform as from n equals 0 to n minus 1 of x of n e to the minus j 2 pi k n divided by capital N. And this is what's known as the discrete Fourier transform, or the DFT. Now, there are a couple things about this, and we'll actually study ways to speed this calculation up, but one thing that we can observe is that the only thing that's a function of the signal is this x of n, so we can actually pre-compute all these exponentials, and then to generate this transform, we can just take the signal times this vector and get the result. And that's, in fact, one way that we can speed up this computation. The exponentials can be pre-computed so that the DFT can be computed as a vector matrix multiplication. But later, we'll exploit the symmetry properties of this to actually speed up the computation, and that's something we call the FFT. Now, if you wanted to implement this equation manually in MATLAB, or C, or some language like that, this is what the code looks like in MATLAB. This is a function, DFT of x. It's got two parameters, essentially, the number of samples and the size of the signal. And this essentially just sets up x to be a column vector. And this then creates a matrix to store the vector, to store the output. And then we just iterate over n, n equals 0 to n minus 1, and over k, k, because we're going to have to evaluate this for all values of k. And we compute, essentially, the x of k's as e to the minus j 2 pi k times n divided by capital N times the value of the signal x. So this is a very easy way, or straightforward way, to compute the discrete Fourier transform. And later we'll, like I said, we'll show you a much faster way to do that. So what we'll do next, let's actually work an example to show you how you can do these calculations manually. And hopefully that'll give you some insight into what this transform is all about. So we're going to start with a signal which has a value of 1 at 0, a value of 2 at 1, a value of 2 at 2, a value of 1 at 3, and a 0 otherwise. So sometimes, you'll see in the literature, we write this signal in a shorthand notation using this vector type notation, 1, 2, 2, 1, just representing the non-zero values of the signal, assuming that the signal starts at n equals 0. So we want to take the discrete Fourier transform of this signal, and we're going to plug it into our equation for x of k. So let me go back to the previous page. So we have the sum from n equals 0 to n minus 1. So n is, in this case, going to be 4. So we have 4 minus 1 is 3. So we have the sum from 0 to 3 of x of n, and then we have c to the minus j 2 pi kn over capital N. And we're going to evaluate that over k and over n. So we have the sum from n equals 0 to 3 of x of n e to the minus j 2 pi k n divided by 4, because capital N is equal to 4. And we're going to evaluate that from k equals 0, 1, 2, and 3. So we can do a little bit of work on this sum. This is going to be x of 0. If we look at n equals 0, we have x of 0 times e to the minus j 2 pi k times 0 over 4. Then we have x of 1. We have a 1 here. X of 2. We have a 2 here. X of 3. We have a 3 there. So the 0 term, well, e to the minus j 0 is equal to what? 1, right? So we can just write this as x of 0 times 1. And x of 0 is 1, so we just have 1 here. So this term is just equal to 1 and is independent of k. When k is equal to 1, we have e to the minus j 2 pi k over 4. So that's just e to the j 2 pi k over 4. Well, that's e to the j pi times k over 2. So this is just something which is multiples of pi over 2. Then we have essentially twice that. So we have x of 2, which is 2, times e to the minus j pi k. Then we have x of 3 times, which is 1, times e to the minus j 3 pi k over 2. And now we simply have to evaluate this for k is equal to 0, 1, 2, and 3. So we can actually do a little bit of simplification on this. If you're a little bit uncomfortable with the e to the jx terms, we can write this term as cosine plus minus j sine, cosine minus j sine, cosine minus j sine, and we can essentially then combine those terms and show that for the real part, we get 1 plus 2 cosine of this plus 2 cosine of this plus 1 times cosine of this plus j, and then we have, this is a real number, so that it has no imaginary part. Then we have minus 2 times sine of this, minus 2 times sine of this, minus sine, 1 times sine of this. So this expression now is what we have to evaluate for 0, 1, 2, and 3. And if we go ahead and do that, when k is equal to 0, we'll get 6. When k is equal to 1, we'll get a minus 1 minus j. When k is equal to 2, we'll get 0. And when k is equal to 3, we'll get minus 1 plus j. Now, why is it that these two terms are related to one another? What's the difference between these two terms?
Plus 4 and minus 2.
Okay, so how does that reflect itself if I drew those as vectors? And how does that relate to some of the symmetry properties that we discussed?
Well, if you drew them as vectors, they would be to the left and like pointed up at 45 degrees and down at 45 degrees.
So this is minus 1 minus j?
They're going to reflect across the x. Yeah, they reflect across the line.
So what do we know about, for a real signal, what do we know about the magnitude and the phase of the Fourier transform, discrete Fourier transform?
X of n is real. Absolute value of it should be.
And what?
Shouldn't that cancel one over?
This is an even function, right? And this is an odd function. So you can see that here. So when we talk about the sampling theorem, we'll actually formally explain why these two have this relationship. But actually, when you compute these transforms, as we'll show a little bit later, you only need to compute only half of the terms, and then you can fill in the other half of the terms based on these properties. So calculation-wise, this is pretty straightforward, especially with these fancy calculators you all have these days, or with MATLAB and such. So magnitude and phase functions are even and odd, respectively, but the DFT also has what's called circular symmetry. This is a concept that's used, you hear of, used extensively in digital systems. So if we look at the equation for the discrete Fourier transform, and we let k be equal to capital N minus k, then we can write that x of N minus k is the sum from 0 to N capital N minus 1 of x of N, and then for this N, we're going to substitute N minus k. And we can simplify this by just breaking apart the two exponential terms. We have e to the minus j 2 pi n, and we have e to the minus j 2 pi kn over n. Because we have these n's canceled. So that's why we have the c to the minus j2 pi n. Now this term, e to the minus j 2 pi n, how would you describe that function as a function of n? That's one way to think about it. How about in terms of vector, a vector plot?
It'd be a vector that circles at 2 pi.
Right, so when n is equal to 0, what is its value?
Isn't it just 1?
1, right? So this is n equals 0. This is the real imaginary axis. Now, when n is equal to 1, we have e to the minus j 2 pi.
I mean, it's just 1 again.
What? That's right. What? Visualize that.
2 pi is equal to 0 in terms of like radian frequencies.
Right, so that would just essentially be taking this vector and turning it a full 2 pi radians or 360 degrees.
Right.
When n is equal to 2, we turn it 4 pi or 720 degrees. So essentially that's just equal to 1. Because again, we remember that the magnitude of e to the jx is 1, but also the angle on this is essentially always on the horizontal axis, always an angle of 0 or multiples of 2 pi. So therefore we can write that x of n minus k is equal to the sum from n equals 0 to n minus 1 of x of n e to the minus j 2 pi kn divided by capital N. And this is just, the only difference between these two is a complex conjugate. So this says that x of n minus k is equal to the complex conjugate of x of k. And that's what we call circular symmetry. And if you'll remember when we talked about in this case, n is equal to 4. So we notice that when this term and these two terms are different only by a complex conjugate. So when n is equal to 1, we have this term is equal to the conjugate of this term. So an additional property of the discrete Fourier transform is this property we call circular symmetry. And later, we will show that this property also results in something we call circular convolution, which is something somewhat unique to digital signal processing. When the number of points is even, the magnitude of x of k is symmetric about n over 2. And when the number of points is even, then the phase has odd symmetry about n over 2 as well. So those are some additional symmetry characteristics of the transform. And why you should worry about these things? Well, we exploit these symmetry conditions so that we can compute the transform quickly. We can save computations. Compute one value and then fill in the other values from that computation. Now the inverse transform follows from the discrete time Fourier series, and this is the form of the inverse transform. And so naturally the code, which we show here in MATLAB, is very much the same. It's just a matter of the change in sign on the exponential. So the only real difference between the forward transform and the reverse transform is the sign of this exponential. And that's why, another reason why the Fourier transforms are useful, in a lot of systems we will convert the signal to the frequency domain using a Fourier transform. Then we'll do all sorts of processing on it in the frequency domain. And then as the last step, we'll convert it back to the time domain and send it out the analog to digital converter, or digital to analog converter. And that's actually how a lot of compression systems work. They work on the data in the frequency domain. So we can go through a similar example for the computation of the inverse discrete Fourier transform. Here we have the signal, the transform that we ended up with, and now we can plug that into our equation for the inverse transform and write, we have the sum, in the sum we have these four terms, e to the j 2 pi 1 times n over 4, e to the j 2 pi 2 times n over 4, e to the j 2 pi 3 times n over 4. So this is an expansion of the inverse transform equation for the case when n is equal to 4. And we can then go ahead for x of 0 and plug in these values. X0 is 6, x1 is minus 1 minus j, x2 is 0, and x3 is minus 1 plus j. And if we add all those together, we get back 1, which was what we started with. The value for x of 0 was equal to 1. And then similarly, we can do the same thing for this minus 1 minus j, for rather n is equal to 1. We can evaluate these by plugging in the corresponding values. And if you do, you know, if you work through all the complex arithmetic on this, you'll get back 2. And for x of 2, we'll get 2. And for x of 3, we'll get 1. So what we've demonstrated with these two slides is taking a forward transform and then taking the inverse transform, and we get back exactly what we started with. So it just takes a little bit of practice to deal with the complex numbers, but most of the time you'll be doing that in MATLAB or with, you know, with a calculator. Now, the next part is an attempt to sort of give you some perspective on how the discrete time Fourier transform and the discrete Fourier transform are related. And actually, there should be a DTFT here. So if you recall, the difference between the DTFT and the DFT was that we sampled the DTFT at these equispaced points. So let's, if we define a pulse, x of n, this is our unit, this is a pulse that has a duration of 2q. And we then take the discrete time Fourier transform of this, taking the sum from minus infinity to plus infinity and working through the math. What we'll arrive at, we showed this result last class, was this sine x over x type function. We have sine of omega times q plus 1 over 2 in the numerator, sine omega over 2 in the denominator, and then we have this e to the minus j q omega. And if we take the magnitude of this, we get this function, which has the form sine of omega over sine of omega. Kind of sine of omega over sine of omega over 2. It's almost like a sine x over x function. Now, if we look, if we plot this function for q is equal to 5, and for for n equals 22, we get this plot. And this plot is kind of interesting because it shows that this function, it has this kind of sine x over x shape, but it goes through these zero crossings, and the width of these zero crossings is determined by 2 pi divided by the half of the width of the pulse. Actually, this was generated for 11 points. I'm not sure why it's not showing up there. So, and this plot now is a plot of these x of k's when n is equal to 22. And this is a plot of the same thing when n is equal to 88. Now, The difference in terms of these two plots, the amount of data is the same. But the only thing that's different is the number of samples over which we compute this function. So what happens, if you look closely here, the envelope remains the same. The only thing that's changing is the spacing with which we're sampling that envelope. And we're sampling that envelope at frequencies that correspond to 2 pi over n, where in this case n is 88. So as we increase n, the sampling of this plot becomes finer. But the envelope of the plot remains the same. So the relationship between the DTFT and the DFT, and this is really sort of the important point here, is that this is the spectrum, the continuous spectrum of the signal. When we limit the summation to these finite number of points, all that we're essentially doing is sampling this function at different intervals, depending on what the value of n is. So the only real difference between the spectrum of these two is the fact that this is a sample version of this spectrum. So as n increases, so the DFT is simply a sampling of the DTFT at equispaced points along the frequency axis. As n increases, the sampling becomes finer. Note that this is true even when q is constant. Increasing n is essentially a way of interpolating the spectrum.
So what you want n to be a pretty large number to represent the...
Well, so let's talk about that. So let's assume that we're dealing with voice recording, and we're recording at, this is actually operating at 16 kilohertz right now. So if you choose n to be 4, like we did in our example by hand, what is the spacing of those frequencies? Well, it's going to be this 2 pi over n, 1 over 4, and then that'll be scaled by the sample frequency. So it'll actually be 16,000 hertz divided by 4, which is 4,000 hertz. Your samples in the spectrum will be spaced 4,000 hertz apart. That's pretty large, and you're going to miss a lot of behavior because the voice spectrum has a lot of interesting information from about 0 to at least 8 kilohertz worth of information. And you're only going to have a sample at 0, a sample at 4 kilohertz, and a sample at 8 kilohertz. Not a lot of resolution. So if you increase the resolution to, let's say, something like 10 times that, going from 4 points to 40 points, now your samples are going to be spaced every 400 hertz. And if you then increase your sampling from 400 points to 4,000 points, then you'll get down to 40 hertz. Now that may seem to be reasonable to use a large number of points like that, but of course your computational complexity grows significantly, as we'll show next class. But even so, do we have any musicians in the room? If I tune, what, piano? Guitar? I don't know, I guess I don't know. Guitar strings are tuned. I think the same is true for guitar strings. So we'll try, if you can tell me if I'm wrong. But so we have this resolution. Let's say we use n is equal to, 1,000. No, we said 400. Which puts the spacing for every 40 hertz. If I tuned your guitar string to within 40 hertz of what it should be, would you be happy?
No.
No. You'd be very unhappy. Yeah.
Is that how they built the original electronic keyboard, by just tuning the different keys like this electronically?
Well, so it's interesting that the point I was trying to bring out here is that even though this may seem okay, there's a lot of applications. For voice, this actually works pretty well, this uniform spacing. We can, with a 512 point FFT, we can get a pretty reasonable replica of the spectrum. But for other signals, like music, It doesn't work well because musical tones do not fall at equispaced frequencies. They have these really weird frequencies, like 837 hertz, and it better be 37 and not 38 or 36, because that's what it, when you tune an instrument, you get it to a very precise.
Even a decimal makes it like it would be 837.52, and if you leave that off, you can tell it sometimes.
Right.
So in micro, we had to do a project where we had to make it play jingle bells. We had to store frequencies on a double EEPROM to make it play back. And we couldn't put floating point data, so we had to leave off the decimal point, and it was not, it sounded bad.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So even though the math tells us we can do this from a signal processing point of view, from an application point of view, this equispaced frequencies can be a problem in applications like music. And exactly as you experienced, in the early days of digital, a lot of the audio purists did not like the digital, because you had this kind of, with a lot of the signal processing that was being done, you had this kind of changing of the frequencies by small amounts and distorting them, and that's really important in music. Really, you can really hear that. But from a sort of from a signal processing point of view, it doesn't appear to be so bad. So the discrete Fourier transform simply samples, you might say, the true spectrum of the signal at equispaced points along the frequency axis. Now, what about the issue of time limiting the signal? So we want to take the Fourier transform of a signal over 100 points, let's say. So we have a signal. So I give you a signal in MATLAB that has some shape, and maybe this is 10,000 points, and you come in and say, well, I'm going to do a DFT over the first 1,000 points, so I'm going to give you the spectrum of this portion of the signal. How will the spectrum of the signal that you compute here compare to the overall spectrum of the signal that I gave you, the 10,000 points? Well, you have a problem, because this is only a portion of the signal, right? So there's no reason to expect that the spectrum you get from this signal compares to the spectrum you get from this signal. The spectrum of this signal could very well be different than the spectrum of this signal, because the spectrum of this signal was computed from just a section of the overall signal. Now, this gets even more interesting when you talk about signals like speech signals, like or audio or music, where you have a signal which is changing properties as a function of time. So what makes, as I'm speaking, what makes you able to distinguish the words that I'm saying? Well, I'm trying to produce different sounds at different points in time so that you will recognize those, that sequence of sounds, as a particular word. Well, how do you talk about the spectrum of this signal when it's time varying? Anywhere where you take that window, you're going to get a different signal. So let's see if we can relate somehow the spectrum of these two. If the signal is not time limited, we can think of limiting the sum to n points as a truncation of the signal. So we can take the signal, this could be my entire audio recording for this lecture, and we can multiply it by a function which is non-zero only for n points. And one of the things you can actually do with this kind of analysis is you can move the WFN around to look at different portions of the signal. But what are the implications of this in the frequency domain? Well, when I multiply two signals in the time domain, what happens in the frequency domain?
Convolution.
So, I'm convolution between what?
It's the frequency response of the two students?
Right, so the true frequency response, x of n, and the frequency response of this window, w of n. Well, what's the frequency response of this window? Well, if we take a signal that's constant and we compute its frequency response, we essentially get a magnitude response that looks something like this. We actually have done this analysis. We showed it's the sine x over x type function. And we're going to now convolve this spectrum with our true signal. So when you compute the spectrum of this signal, what you're getting is essentially the convolution of the true spectrum with that window function, which means it's going to distort the spectrum. The result that you get is not the actual, it's not the exactly the true spectrum, it's a distorted version of the true spectrum, because it's the convolution of these two window functions, of the window function and the signal. Now, the interesting thing about this, and this is, I think, a good example of the kind of what's fascinating about DSP. The convolution of this is a sync type function. As we make the window longer and longer, what happens to its Fourier transform?
It's more like aimed at that central.
It looks more and more like an impulse function.
Yeah.
Right. Because duality says the Fourier transform of an impulse is a constant. The Fourier transform of a constant is an impulse. What happens when I convolve a signal with an impulse?
You get the frequency response of the system.
If I convolve x of n with an impulse function, what comes out? See, now when we went through that in class, you said, yeah, boring. Now we're using it.
Do you get the actual system's properties?
You get the signal back.
Oh, okay.
It's an identity system, right?
Okay.
So, the longer and longer I make this window, obviously the closer and closer I get to the true signal.
What were you saying? You convolve with what? Like,
if you convolve a signal with an impulse function.
Okay.
Which is what we're doing here. To get the composite spectrum, we're convolving the spectrum with a signal which is more, as we make the window longer and longer, it becomes more and more like an impulse function. Okay, so if I convolve a signal or a spectrum with an impulse function, I get back the signal or the spectrum. Okay, everybody follow that? What happens as I make this window longer and longer? What happens to its spectrum?
I get some more impulse function.
More impulse-like. So what happens between the convolution of the true signal and this spectrum?
True signal.
It gets more like the true signal, which makes sense because as we make the window bigger and bigger, we're just encapsulating more and more of the signal. Okay? So this isn't the fun part. Now comes the fun part. But you have to understand that point. Okay? Everybody with me so far? Make the window longer and longer, we get closer and closer to the true spectrum. But making the window longer isn't an option because you're sitting here building this little piece of equipment for PV and it's only got a 1 megahertz microprocessor and you can only do a 128 point FFT and that's all you can do, right? You don't have a choice in making this thing bigger and bigger. You can only do 128 points. Well, maybe we can arrange the window so that we can actually get a better frequency response out of those same 128 points. And this topic has been studied extensively over the years, and in fact, if you use a different weighting function, and here's three popular examples, which there's a look like this. If you use this kind of a weighting function, instead of a rectangular window, you actually distort, if you will, the time domain signal, you can get a cleaner spectrum. Because the frequency response of this window is narrower than the frequency, it's more impulse-like than the frequency response of this window. So one of the neat things about DSP is that you learn that if you're going to truncate the signal, you can weight the signal mathematically so that the end result of the Fourier transform is better. And this is a process we call windowing, time domain windowing. And it's a really good example of how a DSP, just by fiddling with a few weights here and there, we can actually make the spectrum look better. And in fact, these are popular windows. The Hamming window or generalized Hamming window is very popular. And there's a whole theory about optimal windows and such. And we'll come back to this concept when we talk about digital filters. We're going to apply the same kind of a thought process to the process of designing digital filters. So let's now put this to work.
Join the IEEE
What?
Join the IEEE as a student member.
So we can end, you can end the week. We've got three minutes. And if you get this, if you follow me on this, we can end the week on a good note, and I'll be really impressed.
Let's try.
I can always be optimistic, right? Suppose your signal has a spectrum which is the sum of two sine waves. So in the time domain, this might look something like this. I'm hard to draw. And you're going to come in now and you're going to compute the discrete Fourier transform using endpoints of this signal. What's going to happen to the output spectrum following this concept of convolution in the frequency domain with the shape of the window? What happens when I convolve this spectrum with a spectrum which looks like this? If this is our window function.
The two frequencies are going to interfere with each other?
Very good. Why?
Because
if you slide this thing through,
visually you can see it. But
you're going to see, you're going to have this kind of a thing, right?
Yeah.
This is what's called leakage. And what happens is, if you have closely spaced sine waves and you process them with the discrete Fourier transform, and the window is too small, what will happen is, you won't actually see the frequencies because they'll overlap with one another.
The window being too small or too large?
So, here we have three sine waves with a 40-point window. Here we have those same three sine waves with a 40-point Hamming window. Here we have those three sine waves with a 100-point window. So it's more than twice as large. And here we have a Hamming window with 100. So what you see is, as you increase the number of points, you're better able to separate these frequencies. But how do you know, when you're just looking at the spectrum, that there's not two or three or four frequencies here? You don't really know that, because for this window size, that you know, you have a limited amount of resolution. So the resolution of your Fourier transform is proportional, inversely proportional to the length of the window, 1 over n. And when you're trying to do really high resolution spectrum, sometimes you have to go beyond a Fourier transform. Because, coming back to our music example, we know that the frequencies, that the sampling points of your transform are spaced uniformly across the axis. But notes on a musical scale are not spaced uniformly across the axis.
Well, they're spaced logarithmically.
Right, but how do you take, if you want to produce a logarithmically scaled spectrum, how do you do that? And there's a whole science about how to do that. But the point here is that with these multiple sine waves, the window length becomes important in your ability to resolve the differences in frequencies between these sine waves. And with music, this becomes even more critical, because the frequencies are not equispaced or anything like that. So there's a bunch of techniques that we use to deal with this, but the general point I'm just trying to make you appreciate here is that the shape and the size of the window controls what you see in the spectrum. Now, if you'll appreciate this if you go on and see your design and actually try to build detectors and things, and some students will do that, or if you play around with musical stuff. In the early days of music, the digital processing was introducing these subtle shifts in the frequencies, and the musicians were complaining about that. So we had to come up with algorithms to get better at this. And that's what's neat about DSP, is just by changing some of the weights on these multiplications and things, using window functions and using all this kind of theory, we can actually make the spectrum much better and make the spectrum have more resolution. And we can actually do some inference, like ask questions about what is the frequency of these sine waves, even when it doesn't fall on one of those sample points. So it's just another example of how the length of the window becomes a really critical thing with the discrete Fourier transform. And so anyway, so I will see you on Monday. Have a good weekend.